Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey pod people, Engineer Adam here, jumping in for a quick second to let you know about the brand new all-in-one platform for all of you creative podcasters out there. Anchor makes it easier than ever to make a podcast. It's free to use and has all the creation tools you need to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. Plus, Anchor will get your podcast set up on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are found. Even better, Anchor helps you connect with sponsors, even if you're just starting out. It's the perfect choice for podcasters, so make sure to check it out. Download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. That's anchor.fm. Back to the show.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Hello.
Welcome to This Must Be the Gig. I am your host, Leo Phillips, and each week we draw the curtains to unveil the inside outs, those gurgly guts of the music industry. Essentially, this is your backstage pass to the world of live music, where we'll have our favorite artists dishing on the gig that changed their life, festival founders on what makes a perfect lineup, set designers on how those massive lighting rigs seem to work, and much, much more. I'm here with our engineer and producer, the amazing Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hey.
There's a hesitation because he clearly is still a gremlin.
Oh, that's what it is.
That's exactly what that pause was.
Right.
He should not be fed after midnight just for precaution.
Just be careful, that's all.
Hello, Adam.
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well.
How you doing?
This week we have a really amazing chat with the lovely Tim Burgess. As frontman of The Charlatans, Tim has been a legendary figure of positivity and warmth for a very long time, something that you'll pick up instantly from his giggle. In addition to fronting one of the biggest Britpop indie pop bands in the world, he runs a label, O Genesis Recordings, with his equally talented and lovely partner, Nick Colk Void of Factory Floor, whom I love, among others.
I know you had to really restrain yourself from not just making just the entire conversation about
Factory
that.
Floor. Yeah, yeah. And
I mean, you love The Charlatans, you love Factory Floor. How does that?
It's a match made in heaven. Oh, Genesis. A lot has happened, obviously, in the last decades of history with The Charlatans, from multiple band members tragically passing away, to releasing now 13 studio albums, to touring the world, to their triumphant homecoming takeover, which is this May. I was like, where are we for a second? I didn't understand what year or day. Is anybody having a day like that? Their takeover is really interesting. It's at the Northwich Memorial Court. It's a mini festival experience that spans multiple intimate performances from The Charlatans. Exciting guest... Wait, did you hear that? Oh, I heard the distant screams of The Charlatans fans. Oh. They'll also...
But wait, there's more.
They'll have rare memorabilia, film screenings, and more. All really bundled in this place where it all started for Burgess and his bandmates. So that's all happening, and there's obviously not much more that a diehard fan could really ask for. You know, there's beloved songs that we love from The Charlatans, like North Country Boy, Weirdo, The Only One I Know, and so many more. It's really safe to say that The Charlatans' discography, infused as much by dance music and post-punk, more than justifying their indie rock legacy.
Again, if you're a fan, you gotta get there.
Yeah, you gotta get there. And also, I haven't even mentioned yet the fact that he's got a brand new solo album called As I Was Now, featuring, among others, the brilliant Debbie of My Bloody Valentine, Joshua of the Horrors. I had to take a deep breath because My Bloody Valentine does something to the insides.
But that's not it. There are other inside doers.
Joshua of the Horrors,
yeah,
and Lady Hawk.
Yeah.
It's such a wild and exuberant record. I really love it. And it's a statement, I think, of a veteran exploring really comfortably and eagerly. You know, he's a non-traditionalist, completely nurtured by change, and also with this beautiful level of curiosity. And he jumps from genres with a whole bunch of friends, and they're all in it together. Simply put, there's a hell of a lot to talk about with Tim. And even though we had a couple of hours, it felt like really just us scratching the surface. This, my friends, is how to be a musician. Play like you really never went away. Like you're always topping those charts and kind of never aging. We talked about getting put in a headlock by Iggy Pop backstage, trying to sell his bandmate's bass to the Beastie Boys. Bandmate's bass to the Beastie Boys. Hey, that could be a Beastie Boys song.
It is.
It is a Beastie Boys song. But he had also kind of been certain that he already released his latest album, As I Was Now, years ago. And also we chat about him moving from Los Angeles back to the spooky forests of England. I think blondes really do have more fun. Adam, what do you think?
Without any hair, I wouldn't know.
Here's us, me and Tim, having all the funs. Where are you based at the moment?
I'm actually in Norfolk at this moment. Moved out here maybe about 5 years ago, something like that, from London. You know, it's out by the sea and in the middle of a forest as well. So it's kind of quite...
Oh my gosh.
It's pretty peaceful and also quite scary.
What, just because of the ambient sounds or the ghosts in the forest or...?
Yeah, all of that, and there's no one around, so it's kind of it's quite bleak.
But I quite like the bleakness, but obviously sometimes when you feel like you need people or at least a little bit of action or something around you, it can be a little bit difficult because then you're just caught in your head. But so why did you decide to move out there? Weren't you, I think... The last time I read something, weren't you living in LA, or is that wrong?
No, that was right for a while. I moved to London from LA in 2010.
Okay.
I was in LA from 98. So I was there for a while, but.
Gosh, this is a change from where you're living now to LA.
Yeah, from Hollywood to the Wood.
That's so good. Is that going to be on your the tombstone? From Hollywood to the Wood.
I think so, yeah.
But I'm sorry to be morbid. I mean...
That's fine.
But I think that's, especially for an artist, having that space away from the city where you can kind of burrow away, have your moment and not be distracted. I can imagine that helps you a little bit in terms of creativity, or... Have you found it quite difficult to be there?
No, it's just different. I do like to go to London and kind of like feed off the energy and then bring it back with me. But it's just a different headspace, really, than that of being in the city. So I've got kind of a studio set up here, and my partner is an artist and musician, so it's kind of quite nice to talk through a few things with her if we ever get stuck. But
yes,
apart from that, there's no people around, so it's kind of we have to make up our own world, really.
Well, I know your music, so I'm sure that your imagination is quite intense and crazy.
Yeah, it is very nice. I've got to say.
So where did you actually grow up? Was that, you still grew up in the UK?
Yeah, I grew up in a place. It was a place called Northwich.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 20 miles from Manchester and 22 miles from Liverpool, so it's like kind of somewhere right in the middle. My folks are from Manchester, and I kind of, you know, just you know, felt quite, you know, I'll just always think of myself as Northwestern, you know.
Mm-hmm. Does it have, because it's geographically in the middle, does it have aspects of both, like the feeling of Liverpool and Manchester, or does it have its own, do you feel like it had its own identity?
No, it was definitely an overspill.
Okay.
from Manchester, really. There was a town about 4 miles from where I grew up called Winsford.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an overspill from Liverpool. So it was kind of like there was a clash, but a kind of, you know, an affinity, because, you know, we were both overspill towns from incredibly creative cities.
And in terms of your household, like how was that when you were growing up? Was that, did you have music around you? Were your parents involved in it? How did that start?
I always remember my mum having a copy of a Rod Stewart record.
The stud. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, a nice kind of like Tonight I'm Yours. My dad having an ABBA record. But apart from that, there was nothing really to suggest that I would, be interested in post-punk and an acid house.
Maybe because there was none of it, you had to create it. So.
Well, yeah, it was my mum and dad. They did have guitars in the house, and they kind of like strummed along, like a little bit like. Have you ever seen the film Nuts in May?
No, I haven't actually.
Two kind of like folkies, hippie folkies, but they didn't intend to be like that. It was just the era, you know. It was the 70s and 80s, and they had acoustic guitars. But it was my mum's youngest brother, Andrew, who really got me into music. He had a record player and some great kind of records and posters on his wall and guitars in his room. And my mum, had six brothers and sisters, and he was the youngest. And he was the youngest, so he was only a little. My mum was the oldest, so he was closer to my age than me. You know, he was like 3 years older than me, or something like that.
That's really wonderful, and having that access so close and familial, I can imagine you always trust. I don't know. With me, I always trusted whatever stuff my brother was listening to or my sister. I would just suddenly be like, oh, that's cool, you know, like I had no brain really when I was younger. And then slowly as I'm sure that happened, you know, we're so impressionable when we're young, so it's just it's quite wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the Osmonds and Bay City Rollers and then Andrew, you know, this my mum's youngest brother. He liked Slade and I suppose Led Zeppelin, really, and Jethro Tull, that I really liked for some strange reason. I don't know whether I like them anymore. But I read actually once that John Lydon was really inspired by Ian Anderson.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah. And it's kind of like quite, just if you look at the cover, you can probably.
You can tell.
You can kind of see it. But I don't know why I was into that. But they seemed more serious than kind of like, you know, things that I was probably naturally drawn to, like Little Jimmy Osmond. You know?
Yeah. But was there, in terms of, so you had the posters on the wall and he kind of opened up a door, not the world, but a doorway for you to explore new music. So did you have access to music in terms of venues, and was there a solid scene, or did you have to hop in the car and travel with your mates when you were younger? How accessible was that scene?
Yeah, it was always Manchester or Liverpool, really. Except when at the age of 13,
mm-hmm.
A band who I really loved, who I'd kind of found with my friend, in the town that I grew up in, a band called Crass. When I was young, like 11 or 12 or something like that, I saw on Top of the Pops that there was a band called The Vibrators, and they were the first punk band I'd really seen, and I decided that I wanted to be into punk music.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew had taught me all about and opened a door, but this was the world now was calling, the world of music, and it was through punk music. Now at age 13, the impressionable kid that I was, a friend of my brother's came up to me and said, "The Sex Pistols, The Clash, you don't listen to them anymore. This is the band." And on the front it said, "Pay no more than 45 pence."
Oh my gosh.
And
sold. I'm sold.
Yeah, exactly. And the sleeve was a pullout like poster, really, of lots of pretty gruesome drawings and photographs as a collage, but it fascinated me. Anyway, Crass came to town. They came to Winston.
Oh my gosh.
And it was part of a tour that they were doing. They were doing Manchester and somewhere in Wales and London, obviously. But they came to Winsford, and it was a scout hall that they played at.
Oh my gosh.
So
you were 13 years old.
Yeah, 13 years old.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
1980. And, a lot of us went. There was me and my friend, his brother, a couple of lads from the village, because it was an event. You know, it's like no one really came there. It became a scene after, lots of other punk bands second generation punk bands, Subhumans and, Dirt and bands like that came around after, but Crass were the first band, and we were there, we hung around after they finished, and we were talking to them, and they were eating soup.
I love that you remember that they were eating soup.
Because it was just like, because I was taking everything in, and they were like, they were offering the audience food and things like that, and I just thought, wow, this is like such a great band. There's so many members in the band, girls and boys, and there's like someone doing a film, there's people, there's no roadies or anything like that, they were just all doing it, and so self-sufficient, and everything that they had on their banners, like "Fight War, Not Wars," and all these crazy slogans and stuff, I was just taking them all in, and it was just a beautiful thing.
So what would it have been like to meet the 13-year-old Tim? Because I love that you got to experience that as your kind of first big concert. But who do you remember yourself back then? Could you, I don't know. I'm so fascinated by just picturing you 13 being like, what the hell, my God,
Well, I did have a shaved head.
Okay.
And Doc Martens, and that was kind of like, a lot to do with just kind of, I don't know, I think everyone was wearing them, really. It didn't feel out of the ordinary, but I felt like it was part of my identity. And I just liked, I totally recognized myself completely. Obviously I can picture myself.
Oh my gosh, too long in the woods. You have step away from the woods.
It was it was part of my, it was the early parts of my makeup. It just, I don't know, I just really identified with them because they were just like so real. And I have met them all since then.
Oh gosh, wow.
I was 38-year-old Tim. I met them, but I tried to visit them a few times at their place in Epping Forest, but yeah, to no avail. But they still have people camping in their house and stuff like that, so it's kind of still a free for all.
So
but,
you can still go, or you can create your own. Maybe that's why you've moved far away. You can create your own. Crass Volume 2.
Yeah.
It's incredibly wonderful that you have experienced something so life-changing so early as well, because mm-hmm. I think a lot of people, especially when they were younger, they were worried about, you know, experiencing things that might be against their parents or, you know, just things that weren't popular. And the fact that they came to town and you were exposed to that, I think is such a great way to start your, not career essentially, but to plant that seed.
You know, yeah, exactly.
So it's like almost grateful that you had that experience.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, it could have been anybody, couldn't it, really? I mean, I think the artist that I saw after that was Toya. You know, and it was like, just like as great as she is, you know. Mm. I mean, it didn't really have to say it didn't have the same experience after, you know, it didn't feel the same. And then they came to us, and I always feel, you know, that as an adult, that going to people is such a great thing. You know, you can go to all the major cities, but actually going to other places outside the
Absolutely.
Major sisters is a really great thing.
Was there a first song maybe out of their catalog or something else that Andrew had played for you where mm-hmm. you remember thinking, I could do this. I could actually do that. That's something that really fills my heart, my passion, fuels me. I could get up on that stage. Was there a particular song or was it just a feeling?
It was definitely not Andrew's music because it was all quite noodly and guitar kind of.
Noodly, like, I love that word.
So it would have been Crass that planted the seed, but without a doubt, the band that made me realise that I could actually do it. I didn't know whether I could ever do it as a you know, I never really dreamt that I could do it. You know, as a career. You know,
yes.
I thought I could do something. It was New Order.
Oh, wow.
Because they were kind of, they had a simplistic approach, but used very complex, very complex equipment. And so it was kind of, you know, I would go and watch them. And the first time I saw them, they played one song for 40 minutes. And I thought, wow, that is just like, you know, that was a set. It was just one song. And then many other times, I followed them around. I got quite obsessed with them. And, you know, their gear would just break down and things would go completely out of tune. And then the clash that I had with Andrew was over New Order because he saw them on the TV and they just sang out of tune and made a lot of mistakes, stuff like that. And he was like, that is not a band. I said, yes, they're brilliant. That's what I love about them so much. They're just like, you know, they don't care. So they were the band, really. And they had a big hit. And they were from, they were local to me. They were from Manchester and Macclesfield, which is just up the road from Northwich. So
I don't think I've ever met anybody as lovely as Stephen and Gillian as well. The two of them and Bernard, I chatted to all of them.
Yeah,
there's like this calming presence and they kind of, it's not that they don't give a shit because they definitely care.
It's
more that they don't take themselves too seriously. Like every second chatting to Gillian and to Stephen as well, it just felt very, I don't know, like they should be bigger arseholes. You know what I mean? Because they are so brilliant. Like, you know, you
I agree. I agree completely. I've had the Gillian experience backstage.
The Gillian experience.
Yeah. When I watched New Order, there was always a massive gap after they finished. They didn't do encores for a while. And then they started doing them, but there would always be like a massive gap, like 15 minutes before anyone would walk back on stage and do a song. So I played with Stephen and Gillian on a gig. We formed a super group for a day, we finished, and Gillian wanted to do World Emotion, New Order song, and we hadn't rehearsed it, and she didn't care. She was like, we've got to go and do it. Let's do it. It was England. England were in the World Cup, and I supported Gillian. I was like, we're doing it. Come on, let's do it. Stephen then sort of like kind of went, okay, let's try it. And Mark from the Charlatans was like, okay, I'll learn the chords as we go. When we came off, people came up to us and were saying, wow, it was just like watching New Order in the 80s.
Oh my gosh. What? Did you faint? Is this the point where you tell me you fainted or drooled all over yourself? I don't know how you... I mean, that was such a big band for you in that time.
Well, all the questions that were going through my head after New Order in the 80s would finish their main set and then come back. You know, if they were going to come back and do an encore, all my kind of questions of my 16-year-old self were answered.
I mean, to have that experience and also have it go well and be able to just play with them, I can't even imagine how that must have felt. Because there's some form of artistry that really, the ones that overwhelm you by being so natural. And I think that's so strange, obviously, that's such a rare thing. Because you think logically, being a natural, raw, open and vulnerable performer, of course, on paper, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
But when you find it and see it, it's like this rare animal from the, you know, from the heavens. It's such a rare thing because there is such a persona that bands have to put on or that they, you know, and not in a bad way. Having having a stage persona is not necessarily a bad thing, just to keep your sanity intact. But
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, but being able to perform and attack music and approach music in a way that's natural really just makes it all worthwhile, I think. Especially from your perspective as a musician, I can imagine.
Yeah, well, I mean, I love Stephen and Gillian. I mean, I've met all of them and they're all equally beautiful people. They taught me lots by their records and going to see them live. We're from a similar part of the world and they're now friends and they play on Charlatans records now. It does feel natural because I feel like I've known them all my life. I sometimes feel a bit awkward in their presence.
But that's always what I was wondering. I was wondering that now, like how do bands feel different? You know, have those bands meant different things to you as a fan compared to how you see and feel about them as a musician? You know, like, is there that difference in comparison? Because obviously you saw them from a different point of view physically and emotionally, and then you're standing right next to them on stage or in studio. So do you have a different version of them, and do both come into play when you see them? Like, you're like, wow, and then also, okay, I need to respect you as my fellow peer.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like that, but at the same time, Stephen, for sure, is very much a kind of like turn up work and do a really good job kind of guy. You know, he's very conscious and very and takes things very seriously as an artist, and but also he kind of like, you know, he kind of likes chatting in between, and we just like, you know, I always ask for a bit of a sound bite or something.
Yes.
You know, but at the same time, we just get on and do it, and then it's like till next time, you know, and it's kind of that's the I suppose the respect, really. You know, I always offer to make him a cup of tea.
Did you do that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
That was the most important cup of tea ever.
Well, we've worked together quite a lot now.
Yeah,
so
no, I'm sure. I can only imagine. You know, just knowing your work and your music, and how I've literally spoken to so many people, and they always mention you. I've been wanting to talk to you for so. You just seem really approachable and accessible in the best way, and I think that especially the way that you are describing the type of musician that you looked up to, I feel that you have, in fear of sounding incredibly soppy, I feel that you have become that in a way, because you've exposed yourself to the right type of people and stayed
true to what I liked, I think.
Absolutely.
I agree, and it's really nice that you've noticed.
of course, we have all noticed. It's, I think, and especially because I remember discovering the Charlatans a long time ago, but that was through via the Via. And then I didn't realize that you actually started that when you were in your 20s, or were you still a teenager?
No, I was 21 going on 22, which I thought was really old. And we thought
how funny is that?
And I thought it was kind of like a great opportunity to work with Martin, really, who was in a band that I quite liked at the time as well. He was in a band called Making Time before the Charlatans. They were kind of a mod band that I'd seen in London a couple of times, and so it was, and you know, we're still working together now, so it must have gone all right. But
it must have worked out a little bit okay.
So 21 going on 22.
I think that it's so funny that you look back at that now and you're like, that was so young. But when you, I mean, you were exposed to all of it when you were in bands prior to the Charlatans as well, weren't you?
I was always in bands. Yeah,
always
yeah,
in bands, yeah. Okay. But,
yeah.
So when did you, was your first proper performance? Well, I don't know what, I mean, I don't even know what constitutes as proper. I suppose getting up and playing for anyone can be technically classified as a gig, right? So was your first concert with the Charlatans, or was it with another band?
No, I played concerts since like the age of, like, I suppose 18, maybe. Maybe younger, but I'm not really sure. I mean, I was always in bands after I left school. I was always in bands, but you know, never really thought that it would lead to anything. But then there was always a drive, so I must have had something going on. My mum always used to say that I always wanted to be involved in music some way or somehow. But I didn't really know entirely how to do it. But that's, I don't think you ever do you really? You know, you just try and go on instinct. And you know, any kind of money that I made in my job, I would buy equipment. And I learned to drive when I was 17. And I would always drive other people who were in my bands around and drop them off and bring their equipment as well. So there was always a drive, you know, to make music.
Do you remember your first concert? Do you remember where it was? And I mean, I'm particularly more interested in how you felt just before you started playing, were there any, because it doesn't sound like there was any self-doubt or lack of confidence when you were even, when you were starting out?
No, it would have been right, but there would be a catch because I was probably playing other people's songs that were very good.
Yeah.
I remember, okay. Iggy Pop cover versions and quite a few by The Doors and some by The Cult. I remember doing stuff by The Cult.
Wow.
And their first gig I would have ever played would have been in Northwich, and it would have been at a place called the Wine Bar. Wine Bar. Yeah.
Not WHINE.
No,
actual wine.
Actual wine. Yeah. What a funny name for a bar. but you know.
No, I mean it does its purpose, right? When you when you're on the street, you know exactly what it does.
Yeah, so 80s. Yeah. There you go.
So that was your first gig. Was there anything when you first started performing your own material with the band?
Yeah.
And you started touring. How did you feel very natural in that position performing live? Was that something that you felt, you know, came very easily to you? Or did you have to slowly progress into a certain character or into just a different way?
Well, the first band I actually really remember being, I played bass and keyboard for different bands and who played at the Wine Bar but there was a band that was called the Electric Crayon Set, and I was the singer in that band, and I used to kind of like my role models were Mark E. Smith, Ian Curtis, and Iggy Pop. So with the Iggy and
all a very particular style of performing.
Yeah, and it was quite angry, and I would take my shirt off and doing an Iggy kind of thing, and
yes,
kind of roll around on the stage and be 19. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
and be confrontational and, you know, and kind of, you know, it's, yeah, kind of, yeah, kind of quite, you know, not really, not trying to be liked or anything like that, just quite conversational. It's very fun, very 19.
I mean, say no more, very 19. Yeah. I can't, it feels like a distant memory. But obviously when you're getting up on stage, and I think there's some sort of power, well, I can only imagine there's some sort of power in just letting go completely.
Yeah.
You know, you hear about artists having to practice doing that.
Yeah.
And the fact that you just got up there, you know, took your shirt off, rolled around,
yeah,
got into the sweat and the dirt. I think that fits completely into the style of music, and more so the attitude,
yeah,
that comes from obviously punk,
yes,
and post-punk.
Yeah, yeah,
But so did you calm down ever? I mean, not in a bad way. Like, did it settle or do you still roll around? How do you?
No.
What happens now?
What happens now? Well, I don't take my
what
shirt.
What happens now?
I don't take my shirt off.
Iggy still does, though. We all know that Iggy still has his shirt off,
and he still looks amazing. Okay, so after the electric, what happened really is that the Electric Crayon Set played opening for the Charlatans.
Okay.
Before they got rid of their singer who played the guitar. So we were playing, and I don't know who I was trying to impress or anything, but I'd certainly impressed Rob Collins, the keyboard player of the Charlatans, and they were about to ask their singer to leave, and he suggested that I join them. And it was a different style of music completely, and it was more, they had three songs and three songs that they wanted to keep, and they wanted me to join, and they were kind of like kind of 60s instrumentals, and you know, I've always found something in all kinds of music that I liked, and you know, there wasn't really an aggression in this music, but there was definitely some subversiveness to it. It was youthful, you know, so it felt okay to leave the Electric Crayons, although they weren't so happy, and join Charlatans Mark II, we maybe call it, and with another guitarist called John Baker, and that was the start of that. So things did change, and I consciously changed it, and music was changing for me too. I was listening to a lot of dream pop and kind of like acid house and 60s garage. So it was kind of a combination of all that, really.
And harnessing that kind of beautiful bag of such a variety of influences, and I can imagine that even, you know, having someone like Rob,
yeah,
and it's really still sad to think you know, about everything that's happened,
yeah.
And having that as your starter, I think is really so special, because irrespective of whether, as you said, it wasn't aggressive, irrespective of whether you're in a punk band, mm-hmm. you know, the perception of punk is sometimes seen as, you know, nobody really, everyone's in there, it's energetic, there's, you know, legs and arms flailing,
yeah.
it's, you know, there's such a beautiful combination of things. But the truth at the core of it is that you do need a certain symbiosis between the band members,
yeah.
to play punk. There's absolutely no way. Obviously, you can let that, you know, bass kind of wobble out of bounds. You know, things can go wrong and you wouldn't pick it up as you would maybe classical music, which is,
yeah.
you know, a different setup and a different format. But with punk, you really do need to trust your band members,
yeah.
that either that they will have your back if you're wanting to, you know, scream for an extra minute longer, or tackle topics as well,
yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
other people might not necessarily be comfortable with. So when you first were performing, especially in the beginning, all those songs,
yeah.
were you writing as well, or was it a combination of all of you writing together?
So at the very beginning of the Charlatans, Rob asked me to come for a kind of, you know, just a hang, let's call it, and see if I could sing on their songs. And I did sort of like shout and scream a little bit over the top of it. And Martin said, let's do it again, but maybe sing this time, which I thought was kind of abrupt, but
yes.
And it sounded fantastic, and he was right. You know, it's just like seeing it, and kind of sang it. It was a lot softer, and we, you know, kind of made some lyrics up, and Martin handed me a piece of paper that had the word something like "Don't bring me flowers, I'm not dead," and I thought, right, okay, I'll keep that. I'll put it in my pocket and write something around that. And I said, you know, I'll be in a band, but I want to write my own words. And they were kind of like, well, maybe, let's see how it goes. And that was kind of it. And we got a set together really quick in like 6 months, and we were just like practicing all the time. And, you know, we wrote, I think three of our earliest hits in a day or something, or a weekend. It was just really, you know, the chemistry was just amazing. And, you know, I remember going back home and just thinking that we really were the best band in the world. It was amazing, you know, but the buzz.
And especially having that camaraderie and that ease where he could just turn around and tell you like, no, stop screaming. I trust that your voice will carry this. You know, I'm confident in you. In a really, as you mentioned, abrupt way. I think that, I mean, trust is at the core of all of it, right? In terms of collaboration. And I mean, that could be across any forms of art. Trust is really the base foundation for most collaboration.
Yeah.
Do you feel that that helped you write more openly and more honestly, because you knew that you had this kind of family, in essence, around you?
Oh, that had my back, kind of thing. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, we spent a lot of times together after that.
A lot of time.
Yeah, you know, Martin, who handed me the piece of paper, and myself have always kind of been pretty much opposites in many ways. And I think that's proved for a lot of it, a good thing. We balance each other out, or something weird like that. But, we both come at things from the complete opposite direction. I don't know. Well, I don't know what it would have been like if it wasn't this way. But yeah, I think we do. I do believe in him.
You then toured a lot with him.
Yeah.
And did you find that your process of writing and your process of making music, did that shift a lot when you started touring in the beginning? And especially because it's, you know, you're excited, you've got that buzz fueling you.
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were writing more and more? Like, did it just flow out of you and ooze out of you?
Well, you know, I'd had my influences from you know, New Order and Crass, and you know, there was always things in there that kind of reminded me of them, even though but it was a stream of consciousness. Everything was kind of like, you know, I was dancing to their music and kind of like and letting it all come out, you know, basically, really. And it was just really fast writing as well. Things that were going on around me, you know, it's very you know, spontaneous. There was a band who was really into it at the time called The Sundays. Do you remember them?
I do. But that was when was this? This was in the...
This was like 88.
Yeah, okay.
89. And they had a song called You're Not the Only One I Know. And I thought it was such a good title that I kind of borrowed the title. It's like The Only One I Know. And I thought, that's such a good thing to take from them, really.
If you're going to borrow anything, that was the one that resonated.
That was the one that resonated. But we would always write together. That was the thing, really, as a band when we first started, for sure.
But then, so had you travelled a lot internationally much when you were younger, prior to touring internationally with the Charlatans?
Not at all, no.
Oh my gosh, how was that when you first did your first international, like, did you have a total culture shock?
Yeah.
I
mean, everything, you know, everything was, yeah, I mean, we went to Japan in 91.
Oh my gosh.
And you know, America, the first show in America that we played, we played 4 dates, and two of them were the Shoreline Amphitheatre and another amphitheatre in California. And it was as part of Gathering of the Tribes, which is kind of a predecessor to Lollapalooza.
Yes, yes. So you played that festival?
Yeah, organized.
That was one of the festivals.
Yeah, organized by Ian Asprey.
Oh my God, no way.
Yeah, so I'd been doing like covers by The Cult. We signed to Beggar's Banquet because, you know, Nico was on Beggars and The Cult and The Fall. And and then we got met by Ian Asprey from the plane in Los Angeles.
Oh, my gosh.
And taken to this festival that Iggy was playing at, The Cramps, Ice-T, and Steve Jones.
Oh, my gosh.
From the festivals. Yeah, so it was just like
all your heroes.
Yeah, and I think Public Enemy played as well, I'm pretty sure. They were like the thing that I was listening to at the time. So it was just everything pretty much all on one stage. It was amazing.
Did you take your top off at that show and roll around?
No, but I did get attacked by Iggy.
No.
In the best, most playful way. We were all sitting in a kind of communal room backstage, and he came up and put his arm around my neck, hit me on the head a few times.
What, just to say, hey, I'm here, ignoring me. Okay.
Just to say, hey, I'm here, and, you know, I'm like your older brother or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And, roughing you up a bit. Yeah, I love that.
And then he ran off, which was brilliant. You know, it's just like, wow. Just, you know, I don't think I had a chance to say I've got a record for you to sign.
I was thinking, like, how soon after, whilst he was grabbing your neck? Or...
I got it later, but...
I think that's incredible to have that kind of experience, especially when you're so young as well. It really humbles you. I mean, I'm sure that you felt top of the world, but it also kind of humbles you in that musicians that you look up to are, in the end, just people.
Yeah.
And the fact that he could be so playful...
Yeah.
And be kind of on the same level as a starting a new band as well is really special. From that experience in California and then touring around, how often did that happen? Was that a plan to always tour, or did you just tack on to the fact that you loved performing live?
To be honest, we've just always played every time we release a record, and sometimes in between those records too. So, you know, there is an amazing enjoyment of playing, but I mean, we kind of play with most records to kind of like, because we like the people that we're putting our records out for, you know, it's like, you know, if a record label wants us to put a record out, we honor that kind of the unspoken word, or maybe it's actually a spoken word, I don't know, but you know, you do a record and, you know, you get asked if you're going to play live, and it's like, yeah, sure, you know, and we go and support that record, you know, and there's an amazing thing about playing new material. So it kind of comes hand in hand. You write new material because you want to play new stuff, and you know that it's got to be good, because the old stuff has much more resonance because it's older and more well known. So
yes.
So you kind of end up in a bit of a, you know, it's just kind of a whirlwind, really, that you, but it's fun, so you just keep doing it.
Do you have a favorite, like, festival that you've played and traveled to, anything, or a year or a place where that really stuck with you?
Well, keeping it on the Stephen and Gillian trip, yes. we played at a place called Castlefield Bowl, and it's about 5,000, it might be bigger, I don't know, I think it's about 5,000 place in Manchester. And you know, Stephen and Gillian came on for the encore, and it was a beautiful thing. We had Big Jimmy from Dexys playing with us as well, Dexys Midnight Runners, and it just seemed like there was just an enormous amount of people on stage, just sort of like sharing the love, really. But I would say that was my favourite show that we've ever played, I think, and that was maybe like 5 years ago, something like that. But favourite festival. I don't know, really. I mean, one of the times that I was really blown away was in a place called Bremerton in Washington, and we played with Beastie Boys and Sonic Youth and L7.
Oh my god!
It was early. It was early, so it was like 92, and Dave Grohl and Chris were backstage, and Beastie Boys wanted to buy Martin's bass.
Really?
And we had a lot of weed that we had to get through before heading to Vancouver. So it was just like there's quite a lot of chain of events that were like, it's just like lots of bands that I really, really liked at the time, and it was just that. So I don't know how big or small that was either. So. Obviously.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
But so that was a memorable one, sure.
What bass did Martin have that they wanted to buy? Were they just like out of a bass, or did they just want to buy it because it's Martin's?
It was around their Check Your Head kind of era. So I guess they were all playing. They were all playing, weren't they? You know, drums, bass, and guitar. So and organ. So it's kind of a similar setup to ours in a way. But I don't know why. I don't know. It was a Fender Jazz bass, and I mean, you know, they're not rare or anything like that. But it was maybe just a particular make or year or something like that. And you know, we asked them a lot of questions about how they made their records, and you know, I definitely took a few tips.
Do you find yourself talking a lot to other artists about their process? Because I know that you started your own label as well.
Yeah.
So I already know that you have that curiosity, but that's quite rare to, because you have to put yourself aside as well.
Definitely. It's not always technical. I like observing really, and kind of, you know, obviously there has to be a little bit of conversation because you're talking to somebody, but I do like to talk to other artists and musicians, and I find myself more comfortable talking to people who make records and who want to make records, and I like having younger bands on my label, not exclusively younger bands, but I want to see the process of how they're doing it, and it kind of reminds me of how I used to do it, and you know, and but maybe there's something that's new about the way that they're doing it at their age, you know, and it's just having a curiosity in all of it. But with the Beastie Boys, I was specifically asking them how they got their drum sound, and because I was, you know, fascinated by it, and they told me, and it's a secret, and
you're like, don't ask me how they got their drum sound.
But the funny thing is that people have asked me how we got our drum sound, so it's something that's came from the higher gods and was passed to the Beastie Boys and passed on to me, and and then it passed on to other Britpop bands.
It's like the gospel of how you got your drums. That could be also on a tombstone,
yeah,
or something along those lines.
We're getting a lot of tombstone quotes.
I know. I wanted to say like tagline, but then I'm like, but where would that tagline go? It's very morbid. I'm so sorry about that. I don't know where it comes from.
So good.
But so did they give you any other advice, or Iggy, or, you know, Stephen, Jillian, Bernard, anyone that you've played with? I mean, you've played with so many people. We've just named a few. What is the advice that resonated the most with you?
I think it's always like, you know, to do your own thing in a way. I mean, that what has drawn me to these people is that we tend to agree on lots of things. So it's like, whether it's a record, or, you know, a favorite record by Panda Bear, or a record by, you know, Lou Reed, or, and I mean, when I spoke to Stephen, he talked about seeing Lou Reed and the Tots at Bellevue in Manchester, and I told him about meeting or asking Lou Reed for an autograph in Manchester Piccadilly Station in the mid 90s, and all of a sudden we're just talking about Lou Reed.
Just that process of discovery and just discovering things, whether it's discovering that you have commonalities or discovering that you are learning new things.
Exactly. Ariel Pink came to London. I went to meet him. We went for a curry at midday, which is something I never really do, but it was a great thing. And we talked about our Stevie Moore and our connection with him. And all of a sudden, you know, 5 hours go by and time to go see another musician.
Time for another curry. When you're connecting with those fans, because I'm particularly interested, I know that we've spoken a lot about your connection with other musicians as well, which I think is the crux of, you know, everything that you've done as well.
Yeah.
But in terms of your fan interaction, how are your fans? Do you interact with them a lot? Have they done any weird shit? Like, who are your fans? Because I know your fans are loyal and really love you and, you know, have stuck with you guys for so long. But what is your perception of them?
Well, I mean, I go on Twitter, you know, quite a lot, and I do interact with, you know, people that like the band, my perception of them is that, I don't know, they've kind of a bit, they just feel like that they've been there with me, and they kind of like, they seem to like the new things that we do, and they kind of, they, you know, I listen to what they're after as well, you know, which is kind of, so there is an interaction. It's not all one way. I do enjoy taking myself out of the picture sometimes and just sort of like, you know, seeing what people are up to. I mean, I don't do requests, but, you know, I listen to them.
But especially having that feeling of being on that stage performing live, you've performed to such a variety of different crowds.
Yeah.
Number wise, you know, demographic, you know, all over the world. But so what is that feeling when you've got these fans reciting your words that you wrote back to you? I can't even imagine, because you've been around for a good amount of time now,
yeah.
You know, to accumulate a beautiful bunch of fans, but also with all your new and solo projects as well, to gain brand new fans.
Yeah.
You know, that might just only now be discovering Charlatans.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are people, young kids down at the front who are not interested in anything pre-modern nature, which was 2015. I like that a lot. They're confused when we do North Country Boy or Tell Me Story. and that is, to me, what it's all about. It's an ever-growing, ever-evolving force, you know, and sometimes it kind of stays the same for a bit, and then, you know, all of a sudden something just like triggers something off, and I just love that, really. No disrespect.
You like these fuckers in the front?
Yeah, damn you! You know, no disrespect to the older guys at the back. You know, I love them too. I love everyone.
Yeah,
you know, they're all my children.
In a non-creepy way, I love you like I am your father. Yeah,
exactly, in a non-creepy way.
Yeah. But so tell me a little bit about, I had a chance to listen to your new album that's coming out in April, As I Was Now.
Yeah.
And when you announced your band for the new album, you phrased it as this theoretical supergroup, which is a kind of, it's kind of a swear word. You were basically swearing. I mean, supergroup for a lot of people, because there's been such terrible ones and such amazing ones, it's kind of on the cusp between, nobody really knows how to treat that concept. How do you feel about the concept of a supergroup? And do you have your own, your favorite?
It's funny. I mean, it's a crazy word. You know, it's not a word that I would use every day. But it's kind of like we have something here called fantasy football, and it's like you choose all your favorite football players from any team and put them in one team, and it's just like, here's the best. You know, this is the best football team. You know, and that's my fantasy football team. I was just thinking of a way to introduce this record that is 10 years old, and the story is that, you know, between Christmas and New Year in 2008, me and some friends who all happened to be in bands got together and made some music, and wow. I kind of forgot about it, and then even worse, a bigger crime is that I forgot it wasn't out.
No, wait. Back up. Did you think you had already released it?
I thought I'd already put it out, yeah.
Oh, no.
But I was thinking of a way to introduce it to the world, and I just said, pick your favourite supergroup, here's mine, and then named everyone who played on it, and then a couple of weeks later, I said, you know, that
this surprise!
Is, yeah, exactly. It's actually... we've made a record. So,
I see what you did there. Oh, the old switcheroo. The old switcheroo.
The old switcheroo. Yeah.
Let's go through quickly who is in this band. I mean, it really is a fantasy lineup. You've got Martin from Primal Scream. You have Debbie.
Yeah.
Debbie, who I nearly tripped over myself when I met her for the first time.
Yeah, I love her so much.
She is, I it's like she was levitating into the room. Like, I don't, I feel like she wasn't really there, or maybe I wasn't, but she is quite extraordinary. And then you have Stefan,
yeah,
as well on
drums and
drums
things, and
Josh, and you've got Josh as well. Oh my gosh, Josh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you recorded this 10 years ago and you're coming out with it now. Did you have to revisit the songs and remaster them and rework them at all? Or how did you, what was the process of re-releasing that?
Well,
into the real world, not into Tim's fantasy world.
It was always on my iPad, and therefore I thought it was out.
I like this song. Why did people not talk about it?
This this song should have been a hit. I didn't. All I did was have it mastered. I didn't mix it. I didn't touch it. I tried with the Lady Hawk song, and it didn't work out. But it really occurred to me that it was all about the time and place, the sense of place, you know, whatever you want to call it. And to mess with it would have. They were all really great desk mixes. It wasn't mixed, so I just had it mastered, and it sounds, you know, like a record. You know, I'm just happy with the way it was.
It seems that they're all friends of yours, in addition to obviously being such talented musicians in their own right. I'm looking at the track list now, and there's got to be a reason for a song called Inspired Again. Like, I know that this was 10 years ago, but I feel like it is almost perfect. It's better timing now.
I think so, in some ways. Yeah, I mean, I've tried to analyze it a little bit because it, you know, because that's kind of what you do when it comes out. But it does feel like the time's right for it in a way, even though I thought it was already out. But it does feel like that it's better now, and kind of like, you know, the title as I was now. It's kind of, you know, it all fits now, and it's I don't know now. Can you say now again?
No. Yeah, we can definitely say now again.
Yeah.
I love the title. I feel it's very poetic. It leaves you with that feeling of, he's about to reveal something I haven't heard from him. I mean, it's a beautiful record, and I'm so excited for people to hear it. And so are you going to be touring it at all? Because now, obviously, there's so many. I don't know how everyone else's schedules are.
No, you know what? I know that Debbie's going to be playing in My Bloody Valentine.
Yes.
Sometime soon, because I've seen adverts for them. And I don't know. I'm sure Josh is going to be busy. But, yeah, I'm going to put it out because it's coming out. And and then I suppose see what everyone's schedule is. Yeah, that would make sense. But everyone is you know, keen on it coming out. Martin Duffy says he can't even remember making it.
I mean, everyone's losing their minds. You already released it. Martin wasn't there.
Exactly. But Debbie is. She's just like, you know, she thinks that there's one track missing because she remembers playing on something that was quite slidey she's not heard on it. So I'll have to have another dig around. But it was a really concentrated time with people that I really admire and love as friends. And I think you can hear that in there. The song Inspired Again is, you know, it was about going back to a flame that's kind of like, you know, scary to touch, but you know, you can't resist, and you know, the inspiration flame or whatever, and it was kind of, you know, it's just the ideas were burning, you know, really burning bright, and Debbie's bass playing just sounds incredible on it, and I think it's worth a listen just for that.
And it's interesting because often, as we were saying earlier, there's a process and a life to each phase. So
yeah.
you know, the life of writing, that's the first, then, you know, recording, getting into the studio, that's the second. Obviously, there's little bits in between. But then the third is taking it into a live setting,
yeah,
letting that breathe and letting people take that in. And it's a little bit different because I'm sure you're used to that process. And now with this, you won't necessarily be touring with it straight away.
No.
Hopefully in the future.
I would love to. I would love to.
But I can imagine, I wonder how different that experience is going to be for your listeners and your fans, being open to it only on their headphones or their record player in a different, more intimate way, as opposed to a big live gig.
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's interesting.
Because it may, in all fairness, it may never happen because, you know, I mean, everyone's schedule. I haven't really thought about it, to be honest, until you mentioned it. And thinking about the possibility of getting everyone together again in the same room, isn't that going to be that easy? So it might, you know, the headphones might be the only place for people to ever witness it.
But this like alternate universe where people can only listen to things on headphones, but it's an album that's already out and Martin wasn't on it and it's now.
Exactly. It's already a story's building.
Or we are creating one, that's for sure.
Yeah, we are.
Well, I'm really excited for it to come out. And do you still believe that music and live performance, because your career has been not defined by it, but you've been affected beautifully by it, do you still believe that music can make that difference, especially within that live setting?
Yeah, because people are so used to listening to records on their computer or on their phones and stuff like that, the sheer kind of volume just changes people's, the way that people, you know, think about music, I think, when they go and see it as a live performance.
It's visceral, right?
Yeah.
You can touch, smell, hear, feel, everything is much more tangible.
Yeah, and I think it really, you know, to go and watch My Bloody Valentine or go and watch Animal Collective or, you know.
Oh my gosh, I love those two live.
You know, those two, like, I mean, you're really missing
mind
out if you don't go, yeah. So.
I remember the first My Bloody Valentine I ever got to see was only in the 2000s when I was in London.
When they came back in London.
Were you also there? That, I'm not even kidding, was one of my favorite performances I think I've ever seen. And partially because as you walk in, they give you earplugs. And I was like, oh, this is what's going to happen. It's like a primer for get ready to sink into the floor from, you know, the depths of sound.
I mean, I went to three, I think, of the five at the Roundhouse. And then I saw him at El Rey. And I was living in Los Angeles and I went to see them at El Rey. And I saw a truck outside. I thought, wow, it only holds like 600 people and they've got a truck of equipment going into this, you know, small building. And then I walk around the other corner and there's another truck. And I was like, oh my God. Very exciting talking about trucks, but just still blew me away just seeing the amount of stuff going into this one place. And anyway, they played on my birthday as well, which was an amazing thing, in Primavera. Sonic Youth. Together, 2010. That was pretty amazing.
I love that festival. Have you played at that festival, Primavera? You have.
I can't remember when though. Mm. It might have been 2010, and My Bloody Valentine might have been a bit earlier.
Because of the label that you're running, do you go and seek out bands, fresh meat? Do you get to see live shows, or do you? Are you more, because of where you're living as well, do you travel more for specific shows played by specific, you know, the friends that you love? How often do you see shows now?
Not as much as I'd like to. There's three or four things that I've got going at the moment. There's a young band called Average Sex that kind of, you know, play Victoria and Dalston, that kind of level, really. Jimmy's in Manchester, you know, it's kind of a couple of hundred, something like that. And then this, I've got kind of older, more experimental guys as well on the label, Daniel O'Sullivan from Grumbling Fur, Richard Youngs, who's just put out an amazing record called Belief, and just about to put out a record by the Silver Field, and they're kind of coming at music from a very different place, really. But they kind of fall into the same category in a way. And then Average Sex are very much like the new pups in town, and Keel Her as well. I'm hoping to put her record out. This kind of very lo-fi, raincoatsy kind of feel to it.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So there's little pockets of things that come together in a way that's a very diverse label. But do I get out and see enough bands? No, not at all. Most of my things that I put out come from recommendations from people I'm friends with, really, who think this would really suit Tim's label, you know. And unbeknownst to me, I do now know, but I've got a few A&R people out there that are actually doing my job for me.
But I mean, honestly, you have you have so much going on. You know, you're going to be releasing the album. I'm sure I can only imagine you're probably writing other material, and you're also going to, you're running the label, and we're living in this time of gigantic anxiety about technology and robots stealing our jobs and nuclear war and Trump tweets. And the fact that you are still able to do so much and especially give back and run a label with younger artists and being in that environment, I can only imagine how challenging it can be also, because the world is a little bit of a mess at the moment. And I feel like, I don't know, is music a really safe space for you? Is that something that you do turn to when you're feeling a little bit wobbly?
That's a really good point. And yes, of course. My friends who are involved in making stuff, whether it's art or music or whatever they do, but I like to hang out with creative people. As the world turns on itself and becomes even more chaotic, I mean, it's just like rolling 24-hour news on CNN, or as all that goes on, I'd much prefer to be talking to Cozy Fanny Tutti about her latest book,
she's so wonderful.
She's amazing. She's
and Chris as well. I mean, but it
just but amazing.
I totally get that. You start navigating toward things that are feel goods, as opposed to things that could potentially knock you off, which it could be anything nowadays. Yeah. As you said, I think that the ominous word is rolling, how it is constant, and it's difficult to switch off.
It's always there, but we create our own bubble and function inside our bubble, but we're very conscious of the world outside, but it's kind of like, we've created something of our own. And it's a safe space.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for chatting to me. I've had the most really amazing time. Thank you, and thanks, a good day.
Thank you so
and
much.
Enjoy the woods. Don't disappear, please. We need you. Well, that was just brilliant.
That was amazing.
Tim, he's just truly one of the most loveliest people.
Seems like a real sweetheart.
He's a sweetie. And this world can be so chaotic and dark. And it makes the conversations like that with such positive people a real refuge. And for that same reason, I highly recommend going out and purchasing As I Was Now, which after a limited and now sold out Record Store Day release will be available on May 14th from Ogenesis. Get your grubby paws on that as soon as humanly possible. Oh yes, the Charlatans week-long Northwich Memorial Court residency, which I spoke about earlier, is also starting on the 14th of May, so the same day.
That's a big day for Tim Burgess fans.
Put that in your eye, Cal. Put that in your eye, Cal.
That's the new slogan for the show.
Put that in your eye cow.
If you want a t-shirt that says, put that in your eye cow,
tweet us.
Tweet us, let us know.
Tweet us from your eye cow. You can live stream it all over the world. So head to thecharlatans.net for more information. And you can, and also you should, follow Tim on Twitter at Tim_Burgess and Ogenesis Records on Instagram. And if even then you still haven't had enough Tim Burgess.
No, I need more.
I mean, he's written not one, but two books, Telling Stories and the delightfully titled Tim Book 2, which is a vinyl adventures from Istanbul to San Francisco.
That is a very clever title.
Oh, also this summer, they'll be playing Latitude, Summer Sonic in Japan, Festival Number 6 in Wales. Also, thank you so much for listening. I must say another thank you to Billy Yost and The Kickback for sharing their song Rube for our theme song. Buy all of their music at thekickbackband.com. Another big thank you to Lexi Frame for the artwork and Daniel Brater and Dean Berger for the beautiful soundscapes heard throughout this podcast. One final thank you to the team at Consequence Podcast Network, where you'll find a whole bunch of other amazing shows. Last but surely not least, please head over to Apple Podcasts and click on those 5 stars. 5.
All 5.
All 5.
Don't just do 4.
Don't do 4.
What are you, some kind of jerk?
What are you, a jerk?
What are you, some kind of loser?
Hey, I'm walking here.
I'm walking here.
That's good.
Yeah.
We're in Chicago. I'm walking. No, wait, that's New York.
That is New York, but you're still doing a great job.
New York.
Hot dog.
Just hot dog and click on those 5 stars and share some words.
You moved to Oklahoma mid-sentence.
But like and chat with us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter at TMBTGpod.
TMBTGpod.
And just generally talk to everyone you know about the show.
Everyone. Call up your dad.
Call up that dad of yours. Call up that mama.
Call up your friend Dave. Change someone's name to Dave in your phone at random. Call them and say, have you heard This Must Be the Gig? No, your name's Dave now, and you're going to love it.
Silent laugh. Thanks again. I miss you already.
Consequence Podcast Network.